Association Council meeting has just taken place in Brussels. The delegation that travelled from Kiev used the opportunity to encourage the EU to ramp up its sanctions against Moscow.
We hope that the deep sanctions regime for violations of human rights would allow for the enhancement of the sanctions list and the expansion of the sanctions list of the European Union.
Russia denies claims it is trying to destabilize Ukraine and asserts its right to protect what it sees as legitimate regional interests. Just like several other nations surrounding Russia, the EU would like Ukraine to join its 27-nation bloc.
The European Union has already provided significant overall financial assistance to Ukraine. We are talking about 16 billion euros since 2014.
The EU regularly reminds us of its values, but critics say the bloc is often willing to look the other way in pursuit of its ambitions to further expand and to isolate Russia. After all, Ukraine is consistently ranked one of the most corrupt countries in the world. The EU needs Russia. The European Commission's own website says two-thirds of the EU's oil imports come from Russia, as do three-quarters of its gas imports. A new pipeline from Russia to Germany, which is 90% complete, is set to double the EU's gas imports. We don't need a new Cold War, many argue.
As a Russian speaker living in the European Union, not me only, but 6 million we are all over, we want good relations, we don't want war.
Earlier this week, EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell attracted scathing criticism in the European Parliament.
High Representative Borrell, you should resign.
This was for going ahead with an official visit to Moscow last week. However, some legislators expressed an alternative view.
This isn't about human rights. This is a geopolitical agenda against Russia, fueled by a military-industrial complex who need an enemy to justify their millions.
If that is true, as citizens, most of us clearly underestimate the power of the arms industry. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the nation's media and political elite are consumed by the impeachment trial of ex-President Donald Trump, talks on a desperately needed and long-delayed major economic stimulus package have been forced on hold. After an economically devastating pandemic year, Main Street has been clamoring for economic aid. President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion relief bill has a huge 75% public approval rating. But as Democrats issue more of the exact details, fissures are mounting between their left and right factions. Republicans who want to reduce the stimulus package are being accused of defying public opinion. Discontent is also rising as Biden's proposal backtracks, pulls his support, or reduces a host of economic promises, ending Trump's signature tax cuts for the rich, student debt relief, the amount of and length of unemployment payments, the total amount of household stimulus checks, and all while many say Main Street needed all of that and more in the world's richest country.
If we're not talking about $2,000 per month with retro pay and also a forgiveness of all mortgages as well as rent. And I don't mean like moratorium where they have to pay it down the line. If you couldn't pay $1,000 a month, then you're not going to be able to pay $5,000 over the course of 5 months to do it. That's just asinine.
There is mounting backlash over Biden's plan to abandon the proposed raising of the minimum wage from $7 to $15 an hour. Such an increase wouldn't just reverse decades of soaring wage inequality. It would spur much-needed economic growth amid the pandemic recession. The federal minimum wage has not been lifted in over a decade, further impoverishing the nation's working poor and lower classes. The gap between campaign promises and what looks like will actually be delivered may explain why a top poll recently showed that 70% of the nation is dissatisfied with, quote, the way things are going in the nation today.
Capitalism needs this to be put on pause. Actually, I mean, you know, my opinion, capitalism needs to be replaced, but capitalism needs to be on pause from the banks on down. And the reality is, if these measures are not done, these drastic measures are not done, then no, America won't heal.
Mid-March is the earliest date the third stimulus is likely to be passed. Reduced unemployment benefits from the modest and also last-minute second stimulus package will expire by April. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
What was called a forgotten crisis has once again become front-page news. The brutal war on Yemen, waged by a Saudi-led coalition, aided and abetted by Western powers, in particular the U.S. and the U.K. It's a war that's killed more than 100,000 people, destroyed much of Yemen's infrastructure, and subjected more than 20 million of its population to famine. But last week, an apparent change in policy, an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, announced by U.S. President Joe Biden, received with cautious optimism for its ambiguous wording. Across the Atlantic, a different reaction from the second leading arms supplier to Saudi Arabia. The decision the U.S. takes on matters of arms sales are decisions for the U.S. The U.K. takes its own arms export responsibilities very seriously, and we continue to assess all arms export licenses in accordance with strict licensing criteria. Those campaigning to end the UK weapons exports to Riyadh beg to differ. In 2019, following a case brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, led to a UK court decision banning the sale of UK-made arms to Saudi-led forces over breaches of international humanitarian law. A year later, that ruling was overturned.
Well, they say that all the licenses are double-checked and that actually the weapons that they're selling to Saudi Arabia are not being used in the war on Yemen. This is palpably not the case.
Since the bombing of Yemen began in March 2015, the UK has licensed £6.8 billion worth of arms to the Saudi regime, including more than £2.5 billion in the form of aircraft, helicopters, and drones, and nearly £4 billion in grenades, bombs, missiles, and countermeasures.
I think the figures show just how central Britain is to the ongoing war effort in the Saudi-led coalition. You know, these are huge amounts of offensive weapons that are being sold. And we've even had spokespeople from BAE Systems saying that their involvement, the involvement of this key British company in the war effort, is basically essential to the maintenance of the bombing campaign the Saudis are involved in.
The UK's biggest arms company, BAE Systems, has pocketed £15 billion from services and sales to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began.
An end to arms sales alone may not terminate the war in Yemen, but it could be the beginning of the end. Perhaps it's time for the UK government to put its conscience before its arms industry and prevent the humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen from escalating any further. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Bagheer Ghalibaf visited Moscow for talks with a number of Russian officials on regional and international issues aimed at further cementing the two sides' strategic relations. In a meeting with the chairwoman of Federation Council of Russia, Valentina Matviyenko, Ghalibaf said his visit to Russia has become special since he carries a message from Iran's Islamic Revolution leader Ayatollah Sayed Ali Khamenei to Russian President Vladimir Putin.
This important message is about the region and the world powers and has the meaning that the bilateral relation between Iran and Russia will be strategic and deep for several decades. Iran's leader has also thanked the Russian Federation and China for the fair position on the Iran nuclear deal. Europe and the US did not fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
The Iranian official also made it clear that Iran has received nothing from the JCPOA other than sanctions and underlined that Iran will do its best to neutralize unilateral sanctions imposed on the country.
Our goal is to neutralize sanctions, that is, to strengthen our economy through expanding ties with friendly countries that have independence in decision-making.
For her part, chairwoman of the Federation Council of Russia said the visit of Kalibaf would give fresh impetus to the relations between the two states. She also said that Moscow is eager to expand ties with Iran despite obstacles on this way.
Industry, clean energy, counterterrorism, defense, technology, culture are areas of strategy, and this is where Russia and Iran say they can establish cooperation to counter the U.S. unilateralism as well as their culture of dominance.
This visit is intended to help Russia and Iran find a ground for further cooperation. This will help us to stop the global wave of chaos and lawlessness. This will also pave the way for putting an end to the immoral sanctions on Iran and the Russian Federation.
Iranian Parliament Speaker arrived in Moscow on Sunday at the official invitation of Russia's State Duma at the head of a high-ranking parliamentary delegation. During his visit, he held talks with some senior Russian officials, including Secretary of Security Council of Russia Nikolai Patrushev, on a number of regional and international issues, from terrorism to upcoming international meeting on Syria in the Astana format in Sochi. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him. I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The first International New Horizon Conference was held in 2012 and focused on having a creative hub where academics, artists, politicians, activists, and others could cooperate on discussing various global topics and searching for a solution, from the issue of Palestine to Hollywood to the situation of Black Americans in the United States. The conference held vibrant discussions and served as an effective forum to have these discussions. Well, the conference host is filmmaker and Iranian TV personality Nader Talibzadeh. In 2019, the New Horizon Conference, Mr. Talibzadeh and others who had organized the conference were sanctioned by the United States. Even the FBI approached some of the American participants and warned them of dire consequences if they attended the event. I will be talking to some of the speakers from the conference on this debate. Stay with us, please. I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate, author and former diplomat Michael Springman, out of Washington, D.C., editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hull, out of Lethbridge, Alberta, Canada. Thank you all for being with us, and welcome to the program. Well, let's start it off with Michael. Michael, in your perspective, what were the overall goals of the New Horizon Conference? Because, of course, it's been accused of a range of things by the FBI, by the Department of Treasury in the United States. Your experience, in your perspective, with what you saw and experienced, what do you think the overall goals were?
Well, the goals specifically at the conference I was at to talk about Palestine. However, I think the principal goal was to bring together a group of people from all over the world with different backgrounds and different skills and abilities to meet and talk together and try and come to an understanding and produce a common program for change. When I was at the conference, I sat next to an Arab journalist and a woman who had been to the first Gaza relief expedition, the only one that the Zionists didn't attack. There were people there who had formerly been with the Central Intelligence Agency. There were Hungarian politicians, Serbian journalists. It was a group of people from including German politicians, along with a rabbi, David Weiss, from New York City, and Niko Peled, an Israeli-American. It was a tremendously disparate group of people who shared a common goal in trying to make the world better. And, of course, Sigal Pearl Mandeker, the Undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, put a stop to that by sanctioning the conference, the management, and threatening all sorts of horrible actions to anyone who dared to go into any other conference organized by the New Horizon people.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get to that
part. In my
part.
View, it was the grandest adventure of my life.
Stay with me, Michael. I'm going to get to that part in the second question, but I want to get each of my guests as a perspective on their experiences at the conference. Kevin, your take, what did you find? What did you experience at the New Horizon conference that you participated in?
Well, it was almost like a kind of international summit for alternative media and alternative intellectuals, people who, for one reason or another, have been blacklisted in the West and who are looking into the issues that are completely taboo in Western media and the academy. And, of course, these are in many ways the most important issues. So it was really like going to a kind of a summit with a lot of the people that I'd admired and hadn't gotten to know in person before. I'd only known them through the Internet, and then getting to actually meet them was fantastic. And I think it's interesting that some of the most important and groundbreaking thinkers in the West have to go to Tehran to meet. That's why we had Dr. E. Michael Jones calling Tehran the capital of the free world, because the so-called free world is not so free these days. And you know, features, we're not talking about people from a particular ideological tendency. We had everybody from the pretty far left mainstream, like Senator Mike Gravel, one of the great heroes of the anti-Vietnam War movement, one of the heroes of the Democratic Party, later in the Libertarian and Green parties. And then we've also had people on the right, like Dr. Jones, among many others. So it was very well balanced in terms of different worldviews and perspectives, and yet everyone there is facing certain issues truthfully, and these are the issues that you're just not able to face truthfully in the United States of hypocrisy and in the equally hypocritical states of Europe these days. So it's here in the United States, it feels rather ironic that in this land of freedom with the First Amendment, we have to go to Tehran to engage in free speech.
Okay, stay with me. What about that, Anthony? You heard what Kevin said, and we've heard this before, because I also was at a couple of the conferences, and I heard people actually say that they felt so free and being able to discuss issues that perhaps they could not have discussed in the United States. Your take and your experience.
Yes, of course, I did not appreciate how I'm getting feedback in my earphones. I didn't appreciate how closed, how constrained the discussion was in North American academic circles until I went in 2014 to the New Horizon Conference in Tehran and heard, one was very, you know, interested to meet people from Iran and hear new perspectives in that respect, but also to meet Europeans from many parts of Europe, North Americans, basically people who use the English language in dissident positions in their own home turf. And so I was introduced and stretched, and my capacities were stretched to try to move along with the discussion and open myself up. Then after the meeting, what was surprising to me was the Anti-Defamation League, Abe Foxman, to hear these condemnations, these blanket condemnations of everybody at the conference as Holocaust deniers, as conspiracy theorists, as 9/11 truthers, all these weaponized terms used on steroids in a way. I was introduced to the kind of, I guess, big leagues of the polemics at the global level.
Well, going back to you, Michael, I mean, why would the United States have a problem with a forum that most people would say was quite dynamic and is quite dynamic and allowing political perspectives across the gamut for people to sit down and discuss and talking about various problems and trying to come up with solutions and solidarity across the world. Why would this be problematic for Washington?
Well, it's problematic because Washington is controlled by the Zionists. Jews form 2% of the American population, yet they are controlling most of the foreign policy agencies in the Biden administration now. They are desperately afraid of free speech more and more in the United States, aside from the Zionist people. They don't want anything that contradicts the official line of American policy, whether you're dealing with the virus, whether you're dealing with September 11th, or whether you're dealing with the basics of American foreign policy. And in Iran, in Tehran, it was a freewheeling, open discussion of people with disparate backgrounds, disparate viewpoints, who yet got along, who respected each other. And this is something the United States doesn't want, because Iran, to it and its supporters in the apartheid entity that styles itself Israel, is that Iran is a dangerous, malign influence in the region and is building atomic bombs under every bed in the country, and they're going to use them all against Israel. So the whole idea of the United States objecting to any kind of freewheeling discussion in Iran is anathema, because it shows that Iran is a democratic country that permits opposing viewpoints, whatever that they might be.
Kevin, your perspective, when you look at as far as the slogans that we hear all the time in the United States, and also, as Michael said, what is said about Iran, there's a 180-degree difference, it seems, from the reality. So people from the West were invited to the Islamic Republic of Iran to hold these dynamic discussions, but then the United States couldn't handle that. Do you think that this is a sign of a waning empire, that even it fears open discussions in an international forum?
Yes, I think the current crackdown on free speech, which has gone further and further in so many ways, and the ridiculous attack on New Horizon under false pretenses, is one aspect of this war on free speech, which is really a war against the founding principles of the American Republic, because there wouldn't have been any American Republic and American Constitution if the critics of the original version of the Constitution hadn't been able to get the Bill of Rights added. And the First Amendment is the heart of the Bill of Rights, and in many ways the heart of the Constitution. And the U.S. is not an ethnic state. It doesn't have a deep history. It's not one people going back for millennia. It's a group of people from all over the world who are living together according to these Enlightenment principles, and free speech to free inquiry are right at the very. But today we're seeing that rolled back in so many different ways. And I think that with the issue of who was trying to shut down New Horizon, it wasn't so much the realist American imperialist people. Remember, this was during the Obama administration, which followed the Bush-Cheney years with 9/11 and the so-called war on terror, the declaration against the Axis of Evil and so on. And then Obama was supposed to change that, and he did to some extent bring in a slightly different group of people who had less problem really with New Horizon than the neocons do. And so it wasn't the Obama administration that was trying to stop us from going to Iran. And on the contrary, I actually was treated quite respectfully every time I went. I had only one interrogation on the way back from Iran after going to New Horizon conferences almost every year from 2013 on. And that interrogation was just a minute and a half friendly conversation, really. So I think things really came to a head there sort of towards the end of the Obama administration, and then with the Trump administration, as the neocons turned things around. And their main concern is the state of Israel and the power of the Zionist lobby in the world and in the West. And I think they're terrified that American intellectuals will see eye to eye with Canadians like Dr. Hall, with Europeans, and with Russians and with Iranians, especially, and recognize that U.S. policy in the Middle East is not benefiting the U.S. at all. It's actually shooting the U.S. in the foot. We've wasted $7 trillion on these post-9/11 wars for Israel. So the pound free speech around human rights, as Mike Springman says, were basically Israel people, lobbyists and so on, the Anti-Defamation League. And then when the Obama administration gave way to the Trump administration and the Zio-cons or neocon Zionists came back into power, they're totally banned Americans from going to any New Horizon conferences under penalty of going to prison when you come back from Lebanon or Iran or what have you. This is really about protecting Israel and protecting Israel's power over the United States. And if ordinary Americans could see that this war on America and the war on America's First Amendment is being waged on behalf of an extremely hostile foreign interest entity, the State of Israel, that has repeatedly attacked the U.S. in false flag terrorism, from Operation Susanna in the 50s to the Liberty Incident in 1967 to the controlled demolition of the Trade Center on September 11, 2001, Americans essentially declare war on Israel. And the issue, the elephant in the room, it was Zionists who had to try to put a stop to Americans and Iranians having dialogue and trying to figure out what's really going on.
Okay. Well, Anthony, your take, you heard what Kevin said. I want to look at that because with what happened to New Horizon Conference and the organizers of the New Horizon Conference basically being sanctioned, trying to the United States to shut them down, perhaps an average American, if they heard this story, didn't feel that it affected them. But as the old saying goes, and then they came for me, because if we fast forward now to 2021 in the United States, and we see how censorship continues to get worse and worse inside of the country, how alternative perspectives and even which some perspectives which was once considered mainstream are being shut down and controlled. I want your perspective about that, because perhaps many Americans did not speak out for the sanctions against Iran in general and against, for example, like a New Horizon conference. Has that backfired now?
Well, we could see a sign of trouble on the horizon in 2019 at Beirut when I attended the New Horizon conference, the last one. Kevin and Michael Springman couldn't go to that one. The U.S. people were kept out. And then came the year 2020, a year of enormous divisiveness in the United States between the people who supported Trump, the so-called deplorables, and the Biden group, which had a tremendous alliance of power behind it. But even at the height of all of this crisis in 2020, the one thing that both sides seemed to be able to agree upon was that Iran is the biggest enemy, and the propaganda and pressure kept coming from Israel to these wars for Israel. The sort of penultimate one would be the invasion of Iran, which has been pushed for and pushed for and pushed for. And I think even now, with all that's happened, Americans have a hard time to see that the invisibility of this Israel lobby, and it is kept behind walls and barriers and censorship, this unity to support Israel and point towards this sort of ultimate goal of invading and doing regime change in Iran. This is so consistent, and we have very little testimony on mainstream media about this. And it is the most destabilizing force in the world, really.
Well, Michael, you just heard Anthony talk about Americans not being able to attend the conference in Beirut. What does that mean? Explain to our audience, as an American, when you're told that you're not allowed to travel somewhere and participate in the conference, tell us what happened.
Well, I frankly was outraged at this. The whole issue of sanctions is being run by a Zionist-controlled Office of Foreign Assets Control that goes back to 1950 and Harry Truman and China and the Korean War. The issue, of course, is it limited my freedom to travel. It's a basic constitutional right that the Supreme Court has held any number of decisions about and stating unequivocally that Americans are free to travel wherever they want. Yet the executive branch of the government forbids travel to Cuba, it forbids travel to Venezuela, it forbids travel to Iran except under special circumstances. And of course, if you are going to attend a conference that's being promoted by a group that's been sanctioned by the Treasury Department, you are subject to astonishing fines and prison term. And the conference sounded very interesting. I knew people who were going. They were people I knew by reputation and would love to have met in person. And since I went to the one 3 years ago now, I would have loved to have gone back and met a number of people that I might have not met before, or new people that I could make acquaintance with and renew old relationships. So it's it personally harmed me, and I think it harmed the everyone's view of the United States, that only non-Americans might be able to go to a conference that supposedly is based on free exchange and fair exchange of ideas and viewpoints, and that the people involved are able to speak their minds no matter what they say, where they say it, or where they're from. And it goes against everything the United States stands for and was ever built upon and ever hopes to be.
Kevin, can you tell our viewers exactly what happened? Did you have a visit from the FBI? OFAC gave you information. Tell us how the information was transferred to you that you should not travel or participate in the conference that was going to be held in Lebanon.
Well, first I heard from some friends of mine, Sandra Hicks and indeed Mike Springman were among them, who had actually had visits or contacts from the FBI about this. And then my phone rang shortly thereafter. And it was the local FBI guy from Madison, Wisconsin. And he wanted to try to set up an interview with me. And you know, he said it was about New Horizon. And there, we had a brief conversation. And I admitted to him, yes, I understand that you're telling me I can't go to the New Horizon conference or I'll be arrested on the way back. And he agreed with that. So that was, he confirmed that information, which I'd already heard from other people who'd actually had the FBI at their doorsteps early in the morning. But in my case, it was fortunately just this phone call. And so I said, yes, I'll sit down and talk with you about this because I have no secrets. I think everybody needs to hear about this, but I need to record it because I don't want to be misrepresented. And so he checked with his superior and they said, no, the FBI will not allow you to record the conversation with the FBI.
I think we're having some technical problems there with Kevin. What about you, Anthony? I mean, you're a Canadian, so were you not told not to attend the conference? Did you have any problems? Because I understand that you did go to Lebanon. Did you have any problems when you returned?
No, I didn't. I never have. I've always just come straight back into Canada, and I've never been interrogated in any way on what happens to me on the trip.
Let's talk about the conference in Lebanon that the United States was so afraid of. Anthony, tell us about the conference. What was taking place there that Washington feared so much?
Well, it was quite something to be having a New Horizon conference on the shores of the Mediterranean. And I think the reality is that since 2014, when I went to my first New Horizon conference, and 2019, the influence of Iran has expanded westward. And, you know, Iran has been exercising a certain amount of widened influence. And so obviously that seemed to be frightening the United States, the fact that this was taking, the U.S. government, the fact that this was taking place in Lebanon. And it was fascinating for me to go up to the border of Israel, for instance, at the Iranian park on the border of Israel in Lebanon. I wasn't aware of such a thing. It was fascinating to get to know Hezbollah, to meet people in it, and find that, you know, it's every sort of grandmother and child, and, you know, it's the entire society in the south of Lebanon might be considered Hezbollah. It was eye-opening in many ways. And what was also eye-opening was the fact that the U.S. government has become so petrified of allowing discourse and free exchange of ideas in the type of milieu that we've developed and cultivated at New Horizons, that the U.S. Was showing itself and taking such a repressive act, which of course is now becoming commonplace as the Biden group prepared to define all the basic Trump supporters, I guess you could say the deplorables, as domestic terrorists. So much of this injustice and prevention of due process, free speech, and innocent until proven guilty goes forward in the name of terrorism. Now it seems that the U.S. has become so conversant with using this technique to repress people that it's about to do it on its own citizens, on a huge swath of its own citizens.
And hopefully you guys will continue to be somewhat free to talk about the reality here in Iran. I appreciate all of you being with me for this program looking at the New Horizon Conference. Author and former diplomat Michael Springman out of Washington, D.C. Editor of Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett out of Madison, and editor-in-chief of American Herald Tribune, Anthony Hall out of Lethbridge. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself right here in Tehran, and all the crew.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The White House has announced that President Joe Biden intends to shut down the notorious U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay by the time he leaves office, a tall task that the Obama administration failed to achieve nearly a decade ago. The Biden administration press secretary, Jen Psaki, said recently that it was the intention of the Biden administration to shutter the offshore prison, which was set up in January of 2002 to hold people suspected of ties to al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the wake of the suspicious 11th of September 2001 attacks. We present you an article written jointly by Matt Spetelnik, Trevor Honeycutt, and Phil Stewart. The piece is titled, Can Biden Remove Guantanamo's Stain from U.S. Rights Record? The article has been taken from the Reuters news agency. The White House confirmed on Friday, 12th of February, that President Joe Biden's aides have launched a formal review of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, reviving the Obama-era goal of closing the controversial facility with the aim of doing so before Biden leaves office. Two people familiar with the matter told Reuters news agency that aides involved in internal discussions are considering an executive action to be signed by Joe Biden in coming weeks or months, signaling a purported new effort to remove what human rights advocates have called a stain on America's global image. Asked whether President Biden would shut the high-security prison located at Guantanamo Bay Naval Station by the time his presidency ends, White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki claimed, "That certainly is our goal and our intention." But such an initiative is unlikely to bring down the curtain anytime soon on the offshore facility, due largely to the steep political and legal obstacles that also frustrated the so-called efforts by his ex-boss, former President Barack Obama, to shut down Guantanamo. Set up to house foreign suspects following the suspicious 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington, the prison came to symbolize the excesses of the U.S. so-called war on terrorism because of harsh interrogation methods and torture that has been used extensively at the prison. National Security Council spokeswoman Emily Horn said, "We are undertaking an NSC process to assess the current state of play that the Biden administration has inherited from the previous administration, in line with our broader goal of closing down Guantanamo." The National Security Council spokeswoman Emily Horn added, "The National Security Council NSC will work closely with the Department of Defense, with the Department of State, and the Justice Department to make progress towards closing down the Guantanamo facility, and also in close consultation with U.S. Congress." The immediate impact of a new approach could be to reinstate, in some form, Barack Obama's Guantanamo closure policy, which was reversed by Donald Trump as soon as he took office in January of 2017. Donald Trump kept the prison open during his 4 years in the White House. Now 40 prisoners remain at Guantanamo, most held for nearly 2 decades, without being charged or even tried. Joe Biden's campaign claimed during the 2020 presidential race that he continued to support closing down the detention center, but did not say how he would do it. It is also unclear how specific Biden's coming executive action might be about his plans for the prison, which holds suspects in the suspicious 9/11 attacks among its detainee population. Signaling that deliberations are still at an early stage, Emily Horn added, "A number of key policy roles still need to be filled, including ones at the Defense Department, the Pentagon, at the State Department, and at the Department of Justice." Emily Horn claimed, "We need to have the right people seated to do this important work." Opened under President George W. Bush, the prison's population grew to a peak of about 800 inmates before it started to shrink. Barack Obama whittled down the number of prisoners further with his effort to close the prison, but that effort was stymied largely by Republican opposition in the Congress. The federal government is still barred by law from transferring any inmates to prisons on mainland United States. Even with his own Democratic Party now controlling Congress, their majorities are so slim that Joe Biden would face a tough challenge securing legislative changes, because some Democrats might also oppose them. According to the people familiar with the matter, a revived Guantanamo strategy is expected to focus initially on further decreasing the number of prisoners held at the facility by repatriating them or finding other countries willing to accept them. The sources said this could also mean re-establishing a State Department post of Guantanamo closure envoy, created by Barack Obama but eliminated by Donald Trump, to resume negotiations with other governments on detainee transfers. The sources added, in addition, the Pentagon could restart a parole-style review process of prisoners' cases to determine whether, as the U.S. officials claiming, they still pose a threat. Still, any closure plan could initially be hampered by the coronavirus pandemic, making moving prisoners unlikely for now. J. just over 3 weeks after taking office, the Biden administration has not made Guantanamo one of its top early priorities as it grapples with the coronavirus pandemic and the economic fallout from the pandemic. Barack Obama made closing Guantanamo one of his first executive orders in 2009, but failed to do so by the end of his second term in office. Andrea Prasso, Deputy Washington Director for Human Rights Watch, says, "While I'm glad to hear that the new administration will be reviewing policy with an eye towards closing down Guantanamo, it's concerning that it is coming so late in the game. Shutting the facility has been a purported demand of progressive Democrats whose support helped Joe Biden win the White House. Critics say the prison's continued existence is a reminder of detention practices that opened the United States to charges of torture and abuse. Privately, administration officials expressed skepticism about getting the support they will need from U.S. Congress." America's new Defense Secretary Lord Austin's statement during his January confirmation hearing that the new administration would seek Guantanamo's closure through a letter of rebuke signed by seven Republican House members, all military veterans. U.S. Representative Mike Waltz, one of the signatories of the letter, in a tweet claimed, "If we release these Guantanamo detainees, they'll become rock stars in the extremist world, posing an even greater threat to America and to the world." Of the prisoners who remain at Guantanamo, nine have been charged or convicted by military commissions. The most notorious is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the accused September 11 mastermind. About 24 prisoners have not been charged, but have been deemed too dangerous to release. Six inmates have previously been cleared for release by a government panel, yet remain in prison with no arrangements for their transfer. The Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, also known as Gitmo, became synonymous with prisoner abuse by the United States in the early years of the so-called War on Terror because of harsh interrogation methods that human rights advocates said amounted to torture. The administration of former President George W. Bush had selected Guantanamo, a desolate place near the eastern tip of Cuba, because it was under full control of the U.S. military and relatively close to the U.S. mainland, but beyond the reach of American courts of law. The idea was that if the detainees, who were being captured and transferred in droves from Afghanistan and from elsewhere, were held away from U.S. soil, they would have no legal right to seek a judge's order of habeas corpus, which provides protection against unlawful imprisonment. The Guantanamo detainees were subjected to abuse, to humiliation, and to torture as part of their interrogations, the accounts of which were gradually exposed to the outside world by the few inspectors who visited the prison and some of the inmates themselves who were later released. Critics say Guantanamo's continued existence is a reminder to the world of harsh interrogation practices and torture methods used by the United States that former President Barack Obama once admitted were a stain on our broader record. The renewed push to close down the prison is seen as a so-called attempt by the Biden administration to remove that stain from America's global image. More than 100 human rights organizations signed a letter to Joe Biden earlier this month, calling on him to shut down Guantanamo and end the indefinite detention of suspects held in the maximum security prison. According to the open letter, Guantanamo continues to cause escalating and profound damage to the men who still languish there, and the approach it exemplifies continues to fuel and justify bigotry, stereotyping, and stigma. It remains to be seen whether the new Biden administration can overcome the obstacles and make good on Joe Biden's promise to close the notorious prison once and for all.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.